It's an historic political primary season, new records in raising money and voter turnouts. Now the Supreme Court's backing strict rules on voter ID, some say making it harder for select groups to vote. Good morning. It's April 29th, and this is The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
And on this Tuesday morning, I'm just a guy in a radio studio in a place called Liberty City.
Life is complicated. I killed people, smuggled people, sold people. Perhaps here, things will be different.
Not a chance. It's a Grand Theft Auto world. We just live in it.
In other headlines, President Bush is scheduled to meet with the UN's top envoy to Afghanistan today. The U.S. and NATO have committed to sending more troops. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, 15 people have been killed and 25 wounded. The BBC's Alistair Leithhead reports.
The attack took place in a district of Nangarhar province, east of Kabul, on the border with Pakistan. As local people fled from the firing, a suicide bomber on foot detonated his explosives, killing and injuring dozens of civilians.
The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. Virginia Governor Tim Kaine is heading to Norfolk to look at damage from three tornadoes that struck the area yesterday. Jody Waltering heard one of the tornadoes pass her house.
All of a sudden, it sounded like there was a railroad train coming through. Oh, I was so scared.
The tornadoes injured 200 people. Fortunately, no deaths have been reported.
The pictures are amazing. On Capitol Hill, family members of people who have died from the blood thinner heparin are testifying before a House subcommittee. Their testimony is part of an investigation into the contamination of the drug, which is made with raw ingredients from China. 81 people are believed to have died from allergic reactions to the drug since January 2007. The former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, deputy to Saddam Hussein, will appear in a Baghdad court today. There are eight defendants on trial, including the man known as Chemical Ali.
Today, U.S. senators have their eyes in the skies, debating new proposals to modernize the nation's aviation system. One immediate effect would help passengers by limiting how long they can sit on the runway to 3 hours. There's also funding for a satellite-based aircraft tracking system. The high price of gasoline tops a new list of economic woes facing U.S. families. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey asked how the economic downturn is affecting them. 44% of people said paying for gas is a serious problem.
Two of the world's largest oil companies, meanwhile, saw their first quarter profits jump to a record thanks to record crude prices and higher gasoline prices. In Asia, stocks are near 3 months highs ahead of the Federal Reserve, which is meeting today and is expected to cut interest rates tomorrow.
Well, it's day two.
Day two.
Day two of The Takeaway. And we're going to ask you every day to weigh in on an issue we think is important.
Yeah,
is important.
You're in on the conversation with us. And is voting broken? I mean, in Indiana, you have to have a picture ID to vote. What would you do to change voting? How would you fix it if you think it's broken? We want to know.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Your responses all hour long. Listen and win. Win the Lexus.
No, Lexus.
No, that's wrong.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this April 29th, Tuesday.
Good morning.
And John Hockenberry.
Yes.
The Supreme Court wants your identification.
My picture ID?
Yeah, they
do. Oh, my God. I didn't bring it down here.
Well, they want it.
The Supreme Court wants it?
They want it so that you can vote. The court ruled yesterday, 6-3, that it is reasonable for a state to ask you for an ID when you go to the polls, but not just any ID, one issued by the government. It's an Indiana law, the toughest in the nation, that advocates said was unfair to the elderly, racial minorities, and the poor, who are the most likely not to have a government ID. But those advocates had no real proof these groups' voting rights would suffer. But then again, the Indiana election officials had no proof that the fraud the law was meant to prevent had ever happened in the state. In fact, no one has ever been prosecuted for it. So, Professor Nate Persily, what happened in Crawford versus the Marion Board of Elections? How did the Supreme Court decide the case?
Well, by a 6-3 vote, the court said that voter ID laws are constitutional because they don't burden that many people and that they're justified by the state's interest in preventing voter fraud. And so it gave its blessing to a series of laws, not just the one in Indiana, but around the country, which have been enacted since the 2000 presidential election.
So tell us about those laws, particularly the one in Indiana. What does it require of people, and why did the court decide that it was not an undue burden?
Well, it requires that you produce something like a driver's license or another state-issued photo ID to prove you are who you are. This is an attempt to prevent what's called voter impersonation fraud, the idea that someone might show up at the polls and pretend to be someone else. And it turns out it's a pretty restrictive law in that only certain types of government-issued photo ID, such as a driver's license or a passport or another state-issued photo ID, are required, whereas many other states allow you to bring a utility bill or just have your signature match the one that they have on the voter rolls.
Now, Nate, you're a professor at Columbia University. You know, is this a serious body of law that's developing related to demanding government-issued IDs at places like polling stations and other sort of civic places where you would show up to have to do various sorts of things?
Well, these laws are new. They're passed since the 2000 election and the Help America Vote Act, which followed that, which was trying to remedy some of the problems from the 2000 election. One of the interesting things is that photo IDs in this post-September 11th era have become so frequent as a requirement to gain access to all types of places that the district court and the circuit court here found that, you know, it's not that big a deal to ask people also to present photo ID to vote.
More than 20 states in the country have these voter ID laws that you're describing. And will this ruling affect the presidential election this year? Will it affect the voting in the Democratic primary to take place on May 6th?
I tend to think it's probably going to have more of an effect on the Democratic primary than it will in the November election, because Indiana is not going to be a terribly competitive state in the general. But the whole argument that's being made now is that Obama's supporters are, many of them, first-time voters. And these are people that the advocates say are least likely to have photo ID, because racial minorities and those who haven't voted sort of habitually are going to be the ones who don't have the kind of ID necessary to vote.
Do you believe that that's true? I mean, is that statistically really the case? I mean, what are the numbers that might actually be affected in the primary?
The court seemed to suggest that about 40,000 people in Indiana would be affected.
Wow.
But we don't know how many of those people actually would turn out to vote. I mean, one of the things we find, those who do survey research in this, is that, you know, most voters have photo ID. But then again, most voters are themselves sort of higher socioeconomic status. And so if you just look at the aggregate population, yeah, about 40,000 people might not be able to vote. But most voters, or people who have a tradition of voting, are going to have the ID that they usually bring to the polling place.
And we should add also that in Indiana, they say that people can apply to get these IDs for free. So there isn't a barrier of cost to getting these identifications. My question would be, is that being put out there? Do people know that? Is there some kind of public information campaign so that folks who don't have IDs know where they can get one?
Well, they know that they have to come, you know, sort of confront the Motor Vehicle Administration if they want to get a photo ID. You know, and that's the prerequisite now to voting in Indiana, which is that you have to go and get, if not a driver's license, at least some other kind of state-issued photo ID. And there is a public education campaign, but, you know, most people don't realize you need these types of identifications in order to go and vote.
Our takeaway question of the day is, what would you change about our voting system in the United States? What would you say to that, Professor?
Actually, I think, you know, the nuts and bolts of elections are the things that we have to concentrate on. Things like poll worker training, that we find that all the studies on elections show that the variance between different precincts and different polling places exceeds the variance and the mistakes that, for example, occur with different technologies, and that actually the people on the ground are the factor that makes the most difference.
So keep voting the same, just train the people at the polls better.
Yeah, right?
That's our first suggestion, and suggestions,
and that's
please,
a good one. You know. Professor Nate Persily, Professor of Law at Columbia, thank you.
Thank you. You know, in tight money times, you might think, listen up here, guys, you might just suspect that something that costs $280 billion would cause some debate, some kind of sparks to fly in Washington. I mean, with food prices higher than ever, you might think, Adora, that a $280 billion bill to help out farmers would be a little controversial, stalled in some committee, object of a standoff. Well, you would be wrong. The 2008 Farm Bill is a freight train of subsidies, entitlements, and earmarks on its way to becoming law, basically without a peep. We've asked Carolyn Lockheed of the San Francisco Chronicle to join us and see if at a moment when farmers are getting record prices for their crops, why giving farmers a $280 billion tax dollar, whatever, seems to be a no-brainer for Republicans and Democrats. Carolyn, why is that?
Well, farm subsidies are just so entrenched that it is now almost impossible to change them. But you would have thought in this year when you've actually got food riots overseas because of the spectacular, I mean, they're just record-breaking price increases, that there would be some second thoughts toward handing out, you know, very, very large checks, at least $40,000. And if you're a family of farmers, many times that, in a year like this.
What is the net effect of that money? I mean, where does that money go, and what crops, Carolyn Lockhead, is it supposed to help produce?
Well, it's just five crops, and these were decided way back in the Depression. That's about 75-plus years ago. Cotton, corn, wheat, rice, soybeans, and a handful of others like milk and so forth that are more on the regulation side. But these were decided a long time ago, and they've just been there all these years, and that's what they're doing.
And 266 million acres go for commodities, while fruits and vegetables, most of what we think of as in the produce case, are planted on only 12 million acres in the United States. Now, you would think that the Farm Bill would try to create incentives to put more diverse crops into the soil, but that's not the case.
Well, no, it's not. It's the most archaic system you can possibly imagine. Actually, fruits and vegetables are, as we know, we have a diabetes epidemic, an obesity epidemic. Those things should actually be added to our diet in greater numbers, but that is not what the Farm Bill does. The Farm Bill supports basically carbohydrates, starches, and sugars.
Well, there's also the racehorse breeders. They get $1.8 billion, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah. The racehorse people need a tax break, too.
I guess, though
it's funny because we're giving out these about $5 billion now in direct payments that basically go to 10% of the farmers who make the most money, whereas fruit and vegetable growers in California have been surviving all these years without any subsidies whatsoever, direct crop subsidies of that kind.
Carolyn, why is there so little controversy? I mean, you mentioned that subsidies are entrenched in Congress, but why is there so little controversy, so little debate in a bipartisan way about this bill? I guess the Democrats have had a couple of tweaks, but not much.
Yeah, because both parties have lawmakers in farm states, and it's a classic case of a very, very tiny minority, and it's not even most farmers. Most farmers don't even get these subsidies. As I mentioned, California, the biggest farm state in the union, they do not get direct crop subsidies. But these very small number of lawmakers, to them it is very, very important to please the National Corn Growers Association, National Association of Wheat Growers, and so forth. And so both parties have shown almost no appetite for changing these.
Carolyn,
attempts every once in a while, but they often fail.
We're going to have more on the Farm Bill later on in the show. Carolyn Lockhead of the San Francisco Chronicle, thanks for joining us. You know, one of the things, Adora, that was interesting in reading about this story yesterday is that the Farm Bill has become like the defense bills of the 1980s. They're so uncontroversial.
Dear Mark.
They, like, sail through Congress that they get all the little attachments to them. Used to be security. Now it's the Farm Bill.
It's so enormous, and I think what we're going to try to do is disentangle it all and really fundamentally understand what's getting provided and what isn't getting provided in this Farm Bill, because that's a heck of a lot of money.
Well, it's a heck of a lot of money, and it benefits very few farmers. I guess that's the thing to keep in mind. We're going to be talking to a farmer later on in the show. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
A catalyst for examining the decisions that confront people
trying to do the right thing.
Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, April 29th. And John, there's a cultural battle raging in New Orleans, as you and I have talked about. This, according to journalist and filmmaker Lolis Eric Eli. In Treme, a classic New Orleans neighborhood and vital center of musical and political innovation, that battle is in high gear. Eli takes a hard look at the neighborhood, which is struggling to recover from Hurricane Katrina. In Faubourg Treme, a documentary he co-directed and premiered this week at the Tribeca Film Festival, Lolis is a story about a man on a quest.
Well, even after the storm, when so many of our people have been scattered, we find that we realize the preciousness of our culture perhaps more than ever. So I would say that the culture remains strong, even though in a whole lot of ways the city's in an incredibly weakened position now.
What makes Treme so special?
Well, as the city of New Orleans was growing, we're talking about back in the 1700s, Treme became one of the first suburbs of New Orleans. And a whole lot of free people of color lived in the Faubourg Treme. So what you get is black folks who were artisans, who were writers. In fact, the first anthology of African-American poetry came out of Treme. Perhaps most importantly, after New Orleans fell during the Civil War, you had this whole civil rights movement taking place there, even before the rest of the South had fallen.
You're a columnist for the this New Orleans Times-Picayune, right?
Yep.
A Metro columnist. So, you know, it strikes me that, you know, in your street reporting, and in this documentary, and also thinking of the history of New Orleans, this is a battle, the battle for the cultural uniqueness of New Orleans that's gone on for hundreds of years. Yeah. Whether we're talking about battling the river or battling the kind of immigrant waves or battling politically.
Yeah.
It's a really, really deep kind of struggle that culturally that New Orleans has been going through.
Well, one of the things that's hard to explain to folks in the rest of the country is that the great enemy of New Orleans culture is American culture, you know? And it's like, which is not, I don't have anything against American culture per se.
Yeah, right.
But I'm saying,
But isn't New Orleans culture part of American culture?
It very much is. And that's also part of our point. But what I'm saying, though, is that the idea of folks coming in with all the fast food and all the sort of top 40 radio that then dilutes our own music and our own culinary heritage is a big battle that we've been dealing with since the Louisiana Purchase.
Well, has Katrina sort of tipped the balance there? Has Katrina sort of really put the battle in favor of the dilution?
Hard to say yet.
Hmm.
Because those of us who were there are still fighting, and a lot of the traditions are stronger now in that people realize, wait a minute, it is not an option not to go out to the parade today, or not an option not to do a St. Joseph's Day altar in that Sicilian tradition, because we have to. Other folks are not here to do it for us.
You know, Jazz Fest starts this week. What evidence in Jazz Fest, which of course is a major cultural event in New Orleans and for the Western Hemisphere, what evidence there is there that you know, Katrina has mixed things up, maybe diluted things down?
Well, Jazz Fest has always had a mix of local and national acts. But what people who've been coming to Jazz Fest for 20, 25 years always liked was the sense that they would go and they'd hear stuff and find things that you might not know about if you didn't go down there. But increasingly, they're having national acts and international acts, in part because to try to make the economics of a festival that big work, they're going to end up having Bruce Springsteen or Sting or Santana, all of which are wonderful musicians, but ain't the same as going down there.
You hate him. You want to go away.
isn't there
I can see you walking around with a no Sting sign.
Isn't there some level of necessity given the absolute destruction following Katrina? And how do you build that up? And secondarily, are those musicians and those artists, are they still in New Orleans? Have they come back?
What one thing that folks miss is that while there are vast stretches of residential areas that are still vacant after the storm, a lot of the city was indeed on high ground. A lot of areas of the city, like if you came there tomorrow, some of the stuff we would have done 5 years ago, most of it we could still do. And there are a lot of musicians there even now. We could go in New Orleans 7 nights a week and hear good music.
Yeah, it's still amazing. Yeah, I noticed one of the executive producers of your movie is friend of public radio, friend of music, and certainly friend of New Orleans, Wynton Marsalis. Would he agree with you that there's a danger of this dilution? He backed your film. I don't know if he's a zealot like you are, but
Wynton and I've had this discussion, and Wynton's big concern about Jazz Fest is that the one opportunity for jazz to be front and center, to say, look, this is what's important, becomes diluted. You know, how are you going to have a jazz musician in terms of popularity and so forth be on the stage next to Sting and not have it be clear that this is the one who's more popular, this is the one who's more prominent?
Just to get back to your documentary, I watched it, and I was actually in New Orleans covering Hurricane Katrina before it hit and the floods that followed afterwards. And one of the themes that you capture, there's this wonderful quote by a woman who says that the disaster is not greater than the people in New Orleans, and that the will to live and fight again will always be there. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that will to fight.
Well, that's Brenda Marie Osby, who's the former poet laureate of Louisiana. And what has happened is that we realize now that it is not automatic that a country is going to come to our rescue. And that if we don't participate in these battles, if we don't try to rebuild New Orleans, it may well not happen.
Thank you very much, Lolis Eric Eli, Metro columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and co-director of the Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. Time for some other headlines. Femi Okay is here. What do you have?
In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber has killed himself and 15 others the same day that President Bush discusses security with the UN's top envoy to the country. And making news around the world, a group of East Timor rebels have surrendered. Gastau Al Salsina and 11 others are accused of trying to assassinate the president in February. They turned themselves in after days of negotiations. The head of the UN peacekeeping forces has denied allegations of illegal arms trading by its peacekeepers in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Jean-Marie Guéhenno says if any of the charges made are confirmed, the UN would reopen its investigation.
The UN has every interest in transparency. Integrity is our most precious capital. And what the peacekeepers did in Ituri, it's they disarmed the militias. That's why you can be in Mongwalu today.
Mr. Guéhenno also denies that any political pressure has been put on the UN from troop-contributing countries to conceal soldier misconduct. And finally, the Spanish Prime Minister has defended his decision to appoint a cabinet containing more women than men. José Luis Rodríguez said that his female ministers represented a new Spain that had changed socially, politically and economically. Some government critics have derided his cabinet lineup, with one commentator describing it as a battalion of inexperienced seamstresses. Ouch!
Oof, that's very harsh.
Yeah, well, he's not in the cabinet.
We're going to have to investigate that. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Now featuring Father's Day.
A short film about a woman whose father walked out on her 20 years ago.
And a daughter who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather if he lives long enough.
Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
They want to fix voting in Indiana by making you show your picture ID. That's what the Supreme Court ruled yesterday. We talked about that earlier in the hour. If you want to fix voting, what would you do? MyTake at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE. We're following your responses. We'll have more a little later. But it's time for your economics lesson this morning. It's really easy today. All about supply and demand. Lolis, Eric Eli is with us. Economic lesson for both of you here, Adora and Lolis. When the price of something rises, two things happen, right? People start making more of the stuff, right? Because they can get a higher price. You'd be nuts not to. And second, if you buy this price-rising stuff, you start to feel like you're getting ripped off. So you stop buying. It's the old supply and demand dance. Higher demand, higher prices creates an incentive to produce more supply. Higher prices cause demand to level off or go down. And poof,
usually
price heads downward. Yeah. This applies almost everywhere on planet Earth except in the oil markets. And realizing that in the oil markets, some basic economics are breaking down is proving to be a bit of an unexpected horror movie for everyone except the oil companies who are making record profits. Jad Mouad is the New York Times reporter on the oil beat. Jad, thanks for joining us. Oil prices go up, but supply doesn't increase. Why?
Well, that's been kind of the big question mark here. As you just said, these high prices were supposed to bring more supplies on. But for a variety of reasons, really, we've seen a kind of a leveling off of oil supplies globally. And that's getting a lot of analysts and a lot of energy experts pretty concerned that prices are going to keep rising until demand really kind of drops.
And demand hasn't really moderated as much as these quick price rises would suggest it might, correct?
Right. Well, not everywhere. I mean, that's kind of the really important thing to keep in mind here. In the U.S. and Europe and Japan and, you know, in the modern economies, or industrial economies, demand has slowed down. But then you have the rest, you know, the other half of the world in China and India and the Middle East, where demand has been going up and up and up. I mean, there's been this relentless increase in demand because these countries are growing and they're, for most part, subsidizing their energy prices. So they're not really feeling the impact of these high prices.
Jad, you actually write that this year it's expected that the world will use 1.2 million barrels more a day of oil, that bringing the number up to 87.2 million barrels a day. That sounds like an extraordinary number. Can you put that in context for us?
Well, it certainly is a big number. It's actually a slower growth than we have historically. It's about a 1% growth, give or take, whereas you know, world demand typically grows by 1 to 2% every year, but it's certainly a big number, and it's consumption that's coming mostly from these developing countries, from China and India and the Middle East, and that's really what's pushing up today's prices.
And there's really nothing, I mean, based on what you wrote, and the economics, I think, are really the interesting fact here. The dynamics that are in play now, there's nothing really standing in the way of, you know, $150, $200 a barrel oil, based on the way things are going right now. We just have a few seconds.
Well, it is not new supplies. You're right. The only thing that could bring these prices down would be if demand started to moderate or, you know, the bad news scenario, if the U.S. economy went into a very sharp recession and pushed other countries around the world into a recession, that would drive demand down. That would be the worst-case scenario. Right. That would bring prices down.
Well, many reasons to check in with you again on this. Jad Mouad of the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The oil markets. One horror show. Here's another. And I'm basically guaranteeing that today will be the biggest day for the entertainment industry for all of 2008. Do you know what I'm talking about, Adora?
No, actually, I don't, John.
Today, the blockbuster video, you know what I'm talking about. The blockbuster video game Grand Theft Auto comes out with its fourth edition, Grand Theft Auto 4. Brian, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Should I actually call you Nico? I mean, are you packing right now, buddy?
No, I'm not.
How many people have you blown away in the last 24 hours?
Zero. I haven't. I actually don't have the game right now.
In this installment of Grand Theft Auto, players take on the role of a European immigrant named Nico, right? And they navigate through the streets of a very New York-looking Liberty City, right?
Yes.
Breaking any number of laws, correct?
Yes.
And Grand Theft Auto, as everyone knows, is a game with cinematic sweep, and this edition is expected to break records as the biggest-selling game ever. Brian Crescenti is a journalist, right?
Yes,
I am. You're a journalist, yeah. And you've been playing the game until this morning for 11 hours a day, either as a reviewer or some kind of alternative to waterboarding or something. Are you having a blast, Brian?
Yeah, no, I played through it to prepare for the review I wrote for the newspaper here, the Rocky Mountain News, and also to do some stories that I ran on the website I run, Kotaku.
Now, you know, Grand Theft Auto is known for having moral, I mean, zero morality in terms of the kinds of things you can do in the game. We know that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. What sort of technological elements of the game make it different?
It's a game that sort of brings a high polish to video games in general. So a lot of other games have done, but it does it very well. So it looks, as you mentioned, it looks very cinematic, and it does things like in this version, there's this amazing story that takes about 35 hours to get through, and you actually can change the way that story ends, which is pretty amazing.
And there's many, many places you can go. I mean, unlike war games, there's all kinds of scenarios. There's celebrities inside the game. There's depth of sort of digressions that you can take that's really unlike any other game.
Yeah, one of the really fascinating things is its take on media. There are radio stations in the game with talk show hosts and with DJs. There's a television. You can sit down and watch hours and hours of original programming. You can go to a comedy club and actually watch stand-up, and they've got a form of internet that's not real internet. It's one that they've created where you can do sort of faux online dating or send emails to people. There's a cell phone where you can call people, and it's really fascinating. Just that one element is pretty amazing.
I mean, Brian, but at the end of the day, this I've always found Grand Theft Auto to be extraordinarily disturbing in the level of violence and the rewards for being as violent as possible.
See, I don't know if I'd agree with the fact that it rewards violent behavior. I think what it is, and you know, in each game you have to sort of take separately. But in this game, it's almost like if you could compare it to something like Once Upon a Time in America or Scarface. I mean, it's a story that has a level of violence in it, but there is this story of Nico Bellic, who's sort of struggling with this mystery that you sort of unwinds as you play through it. And as you play through it, there's actually some morality that comes into it. And I don't want to kind of ruin the story.
Well, no, don't ruin the story. And I think Adora and I will agree to disagree on the morality of Grand Theft Auto. But Brian Crescenti, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
He's a freelance writer for the Rocky Mountain News. You're not going to play with me?
No.
Come on.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Of course, The Takeaway is way more than a radio show. I mean, it's a much bigger deal than a radio show.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you're with us here in the studio because you're with us online. There are so many ways for you to be a part of the conversation. Remind everyone of the question we asked today.
Our question today is voting in America broken, and how would you fix it?
Do you think it's broken?
I think there's always ways to make improvements, but I think the system overall has some really good points.
Well, moving voting to Saturday and Sunday. Tuesday is not working. We're not an agrarian society. It does not take us a day to get into town after the Sabbath. That's from John Hahn from Northern New Jersey via email. That's really interesting because there is history as to why voting is on Tuesday.
Well, that's how it started. It was way back when they needed folks to harvest on Saturday, go to church on Sunday, and travel on Monday, which then made Tuesday the most viable day of the week to vote.
We've been getting all kinds of... That's pretty much how I do it. That's what I do.
Yeah, right. You're planting. We've been getting all kinds of responses via SpinVox and also by
email. Explain SpinVox.
SpinVox, you call 1-877-8-MY-TAKE and you give us your response and it's tape recorded and then it's simultaneously transcribed into text so we can read it or we can do this, which is play a little bit of your response.
My name is Robin Berman.
I'm a high school teacher in Yonkers, New York. I think the Supreme Court decision in Indiana smacks almost of Jim Crow. The people least able to provide photo ID are the people most disenfranchised, and those tend to be Democrats. So take it away, takeaway.
Hi, this is David from New York City, and my take on what's wrong with the election process is that the primary system is not good. Tradition of having Iowa and New Hampshire always being first has really disenfranchised a lot of voters. I mean, if you look at the voters in the remaining primaries, they don't have the same selection that the voters of Iowa and New Hampshire did. Plus, you've got all the variations. Is it a caucus? Is it a primary? How is this lack of conformity or uniformity helping America? I really don't think it is.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, we've got some calls for improvements as well as some complaints about the existing system. I mean, that first spin box was kind of interesting in that the Supreme Court allowed the Iowa decision to go ahead, even though the state really didn't prove there was any threat of voter fraud. Indiana. I think that's really, really interesting. Regarding how we can motivate America, turn the clock back, says Joseph from Manhattan. This is also a spin box. When Ronald Reagan won the election, nobody cared. Don't know what he's getting at there. So we have to turn the clock back and motivate the people to go back to vote in the elections. He wants higher voter turnout. Have a nice day, guys. Keep up the good work. Well, what would the motivation be? There's a couple of motivator suggestions.
Yeah, Erica from White Plains says, one of the major problems with our voting system is complete morons are allowed to vote. I'm quoting here. As a result, we keep getting politicians who not only are corrupt and undependable, but in some cases are downright criminals. Voters need to be educated, unfortunately, thinking people such as yourselves and myself have a vote, which is equal to the homeless, wino, or drug addict that lives on the streets. Eric feels very strongly.
Well, I'm definitely part of the pro-moron constituency here in the United States. I think morons should be allowed to vote.
What do you think? Is voting in America broken? We want to hear from you. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Especially the morons.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Asking, what is responsibility in this day and age?
Everybody has their own opinion.
Thoughts shared at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It is April 29th, Tuesday, and we are taking a look at the Supreme Court decision requiring voters in Indiana to show identifications. We're following the economics of the increasing oil prices and the release of Grand Theft Auto, which is taking
cultural
place.
Event.
A big, huge
monster
cultural event. And we're taking a look at the Farm Bill, trying to understand this enormous bill that is in front of the folks in Congress today, and to understand the broad implications. For some firsthand perspective on just how it's affecting American farmers, George Naylor joins us from his farm in Chardon, Iowa, where he grows soybeans and corn on 470 acres of land. But George, you tell us you'd rather be growing something else. What is it?
Well, if I was to really, care about my land and think about passing it on to the next generation in better shape and use less chemicals and fertilizer, I would try to have a diversified family farm where I had livestock involved, and so I could have hay and pasture and oats or small grains as part of the crop rotation.
Why can't you?
Well, because we've had such bad farm programs over the years that did not deal with the nature of agricultural markets like that should have, like the farm bills did in the New Deal, so that the typical situation was that corn and soybean prices were very low, and they became cheap feed for industrial livestock operations, the factory farms that we all know are so notorious and so destructive to the land and so abusive of the animals. So consequently, the livestock industry has been taken over basically by Cargill and Smithfield and Tyson.
Are those big corporate farms?
Those are big, huge processing companies, and they often raise their own livestock now.
Well, Tyson is the chicken company. Cargill is really the grain and infrastructure.
Yes.
And what was the other one?
they are also beef processors, right, and pork processors, and they also raise pork and beef themselves.
George Naylor, many thanks. Corn and soybean farmer in Chardon, Iowa. We'll talk to you again. Right now, it's time for some other headlines, and Femi Okay is here with those. Hi there, Femi.
Hello to you, Adora. Iraq's former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz is on trial for mass murder in Baghdad. A suicide bomber kills 15 in Afghanistan. And Virginia's governor tours tornado-hit neighborhoods. In sports news, Kobe Bryant helped the LA Lakers sweep their first round playoffs against the Denver Nuggets. Bryant scored 31 points, with 14 of those coming in the last 5.5 minutes.
We managed to stick to our execution and to not waver from that and to not get flustered or frustrated. And we're able to do it, so it's a big step for us.
The Lakers will meet the winner of the Utah-Houston series, where the Jazz is currently leading. Only one playoff game in the NHL last night. Philadelphia jumped out to a 2-1 series lead following a 3-2 victory over Montreal on Monday. Martin Brieran made 32 saves in the net for the Flyers in the win. And finally, deported for climbing. Nepal has deported an American, William Holland, who was found on Mount Everest with a Free Tibet banner. Holland, who's from Virginia, is the first climber to be stopped by authorities in Nepal. They are trying to prevent protests during the Everest leg of the Olympic torch relay, which starts May the 1st to May the 10th. Probably the toughest leg.
Imagine getting all the way to the top of the mountain and getting deported. Thank you, Femi.
That's tough.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Everybody makes mistakes.
How much do you love Miley Cyrus?
Infinity.
How much do you love Hannah Montana?
Infinity.
In our continuing coverage of cultural events in America, that's a question a lot of parents are asking their kids this morning. After a racy photo of 15-year-old Miley Cyrus was taken by Annie Leibovitz for the May issue of Vanity Fair, the teen star of the Hannah Montana empire is apologizing for the photos in which she appears to be topless, wrapped in a blanket. What's the buzz in the Hannah Montana demographic? Why do you think Miley Cyrus is apologizing for doing that picture?
Because she doesn't want to lose her fans.
Yeah. And then if she loses a lot of her fans, then Disney Channel will dump her and she might not be able to get somewhere else.
I see. And are you her fans?
No.
So she doesn't have to worry about losing you?
No.
Yes, the 9-year-old demographic of Miley Cyrus, alias Hannah Montana. Mary Elizabeth Williams is the Takeaway's cultural critic and a parent for whom this issue couldn't be more relevant. Mary Elizabeth, what's a parent to do in this case?
Good morning. Are those your kids?
Those are my two 9-year-olds, yes.
Mine was the one saying she loves her infinity.
Infinity. Yes.
Infinity. Right. When I heard Nobody's Perfect, I felt like I was having a flashback to being in my apartment because that's the soundtrack of my life.
Of your life, yeah.
Basically, yeah. So, have you seen the photo?
I've seen the photo.
What do you think?
Knowing the way Vanity Fair does these things and knowing a little bit about the way Annie Leibovitz does these things, it seems to me the parents were in on this and that they're apologizing now as a kind of a face-saving gesture.
Well, nobody gets their picture taken by Annie Leibovitz by accident.
Right.
You don't stumble into a Vanity Fair.
Exactly.
Shoot, that doesn't just happen. It's not like getting your picture taken by Joe Francis on the beach at Daytona for some beads and maybe a trucker hat.
It's not a long lens paparazzi shot.
No. It's exactly. And that's the other thing is it's not a paparazzi shot. She went into this. And if you go on the VF website, you can see a slideshow from this shoot. You can see a video from the shoot. There are lots of people around her. Annie Leibovitz has said this was shot digitally. She saw the photographs as we were shooting them. And in the story, she says, "It's a beautiful shot, and I thought it was really cool."
So what do you make of my two 9-year-olds, you know, thinking that Disney Channel might dump her if this photo thing gets out of hand? Do you think there's any chance of that?
You have incredibly savvy kids. They know their way around marketing very well. Of course not. The Disney people were there. She is a 15-year-old girl. She has a 7-book deal.
She makes $18 million in 2007.
I mean, she is set to make $1 billion before she turns 18. Her movie that she did in January set the highest per screen average of any movie ever. To give you some context, it was $45,000 per screen. The next highest grossing film was $4,000.
Wow.
That's how huge she is. She is the biggest thing to happen to Disney since The Mouse.
So it's all about preventing the Britney Spears scenario.
But it's not Britney. It's not at all. That's the thing that's been lost in all of the controversy. You know, I've gone on the blogosphere and you see people saying this is soft core child pornography. Her parents should be arrested. It's a very modest picture. If anything, it's a very boring photo. I talked to a photographer friend of mine who's done cover photos yesterday, and he said that's the disappointment in this, is it's just so stock wrote Annie Leibovitz kind of a picture. There's nothing unusual or controversial about it, really. It's like a salon painting. It's very modest. It's not at all, it's not really sexy. And Lucy also said off the record, she thought that...
That's your daughter.
That's my daughter, that she looked a little like a zombie in the picture. So it's not a sexy picture. It's not the same thing as stumbling around Hollywood with a bottle of Jack in your hand. But I think that Disney knows that this is a woman, this is a girl who's becoming a woman. She's a cash cow for them. By the time her contract ends, she's going to be 18. They want to make sure that she is presented not just as Hannah, but as a growing woman.
Well, Mary Elizabeth, thank you very much. And we'll be following this pretty closely, I guess, as soon as we
both have
9-year-olds, that's for sure. She wanders around Hollywood with a bottle of Jack in her hand for us. Mary Elizabeth Williams, blogger and host of Salon's Table Talk. Thank you very much. You can keep your responses coming to thetakeaway.org, of course. The Supreme Court has ruled that states do not violate a voter's constitutional rights by requiring a photo ID. So we're asking you, is voting in America broken? How would you fix it?
And you can also get to us by emailing us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call our spin box line at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. And Raj in Newark says we have to make voting easier. Taking time off from work is hard for people, and there's no reason to pay that price. With new technologies, I'm sure we can make voting faster and easier.
We're huge in Newark. We are huge in Newark. And Yonkers and White Plains
and
Brooklyn. Ethan says we should be allowed to vote the minute we're convinced and the minute we decide. We should be able to send in our vote by email or snail mail so we don't have to endure a year of campaigning. I sort of like that idea. That way we eliminate the Electoral College, it's direct and it's finished, and when the masses make it impossible for another candidate to catch up. Remember, this is a different kind of radio show. That means you are a big part of it. You can send us your story. We'll read or play back the best of them on the air. We read every single one of your responses.
Here's Jeffrey Salzberg from Jersey City. If there were a way to keep it from being abused, as was the poll tax in years past, I'd like to see people be required to pass a current events test before voting. The questions and answers would be published well in advance. The goal is to educate, not prevent people from voting.
Is the goal to have people vote, actually? I mean, a current events test?
I mean,
like a geography test?
Would be,
that's going to reduce voter turnout in America.
Well, we do have a problem with that, which is why in places like Australia, it's against the law not to vote.
Anyway, come to our website, mix it up with us. This week, we're going to be following Andrea Bernstein, who's in Indiana, following the primary coming up on May 6th. Lots on our website. Stay with us at the Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.